House Education Finance Committee will come to order. We don't quite have a quorum yet, so we'll have to wait for a moment on minutes. But because we are still carrying over with some testimony and then probably questions on our hearing topic from yesterday, which is mental health services for students in our schools. We want to get going. So, Representative Juergens, I understand you wanted to bring to our attention something important, so let's hear what that is.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I did this last year, too. Just wanted to remind people. Well, this morning I had the opportunity to go to Hastings Bus Company at 6 in the morning and greet and thank all of the bus drivers. Today is Minnesota Bus Driver Appreciation Day.
Yes.
And so just to remind people that these are the people that get our kids to and from school safely every day. And so if you see a bus driver or a dispatcher or an aide or a mechanic, just make sure you remember to thank them today for the work that they do.
Thank you. And thank you so much for drawing our attention to that. They are very important. And so we appreciate the good work that they do. And, again, making sure that our kids stay safe, that's, they're a key part of that link in the chain. So. With that, we are again going to resume our topic from yesterday, which is mental health services. And then once we've gone through that topic, actually the hearing that we had arranged for today would be on fiscal transparency and accountability overview. Some of this is stemming from the requirements of the new ESSA law. So that will be the second topic we'll be addressing today. But first, Mr. Uni, thank you so much for allowing us to kind of cut your presentation in half or more than half and short and your willingness to come back and resume that today. So what I'd like to do is go ahead and start with you, and we were going to have you do sort of an overview and reporting on some of the programs that we have in place or have funded to help our schools with some of these issues and these topics. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it back over to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Again, my name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Department of Education. Just to continue off from where the hearing was yesterday, we spoke about the intermediate schools grants. Remaining to speak on is the Support Our Students grants, positive behavioral and intervention supports training, and the use of compensatory revenue and safe schools revenue as it pertains to mental health services. So to start off, Support Our Students grants was a 2016 grant. It was $12.133 million for fiscal year 17 through fiscal year 22. So a model we haven't really seen in recent years, able to spend the funding over 6 years. So it's a 6-year matching grant. For the first 4 years, it's a one-to-one, so $1 state money, $1 local money match. And then in the final 2 years, it will be $3 local to $1 state match. This is funding student support personnel, so that's individuals licensed to serve as school counselors, school psychologists, school social workers, school nurses, or chemical dependency counselors. Districts, charters, intermediates, and cooperatives are all eligible to receive this funding. Priority was set to give districts school sites who did not have any positions existing at that time to the top of the list with their applications. There was an equal split between Greater Minnesota and the Metro to the extent practicable, and additional criteria used were caseloads, demographics, Title I revenue, and graduation rates. And as kind of was noted through what I had just said, the overall purpose is to get the presence of these professionals in the schools, reduce caseloads, provide effective guidance for services, have an impact on academic achievement, and improve overall school safety and climate. So as you can see, the list we've provided of all the placements of the individuals who were brought on, and as a breakdown, I have the numbers here. There were 4 positions hired for alcohol and dependency counselors, 38 positions for school counselors, 3 for school nurses, 8 school psychologists, and 21 social workers. And you can note that it shows the grantee, the school site, and the position of who the position was out of the allowable positions under this grant program. Madam Chair, that completes my overview of this. I can stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. Any particular questions at this time on the Support Our Students grant? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Uni, did you consider population of the school as one of your criteria?
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, we did look at demographics, and I don't know if that focused on the specific student groups or if it focused on the overall population. We did notice that there, we did have a split between Greater Minnesota and Minnesota, so generally smaller schools being in Greater Minnesota, there was a focus there, but I can go back and check to see what the components were within demographics.
Representative Erickson?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. All right. I don't see any other questions at this particular moment, so why don't we have you go ahead, Mr. Uni, and talk about the other two programs and revenue streams.
Great. Madam Chair, members, the next program is Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports. As you know, this was a grant in 2016. It was one time $2.75 million for implementation of PBIS statewide. This greatly expanded our ability to bring on trainings for schools. We actually were able to bring that out to increase the number of schools that we reached to 645 participating in cohort training. This is about 31% of Minnesota schools, about 35.6% of the student population. We did recently put in a definition of PBIS into statute. You can see that below. I won't go through the components of it. But just for all of you, it's a systemic approach in school using best practices research to reduce the use of restrictive procedures and to promote more proactive interventions, not only with the individual student, but also to improve the overall climate. We're looking at, again, school safety, we're looking at climate, and we're looking at positive relations between staff members and students on a general basis. If you look on the second page, I'm more than happy to provide an electronic copy, which is in color to the committee, but you can see here is a distribution statewide by district of where we have PBIS implementation in terms of training. And if you look at the key down at the bottom, it's noted by districts with 60% more of schools who have it, or districts with 1% to 59% of schools having it. Or if you see in the white, districts with white as their indicator, there are no schools in that district that have had the training to date from when this graph was created. That completes my overview. Madam Chair, I can stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. And the grant money, I assume it's provided for the training, so the trainers, we have to pay for them. Do the schools also receive some of that money to then implement the PBIS program throughout their district buildings, or where does the grant money go specifically?
Madam Chair, it goes for the training, so for the actual training modules, for the training sessions. And obviously, in a way, the trainings are provided to the districts. They're provided with best practices resources to able to implement, but there's no direct grants to districts.
Okay. And then the 645 schools to date, so is that what's been allowable with the resources provided, or is there a waiting list, or is it just kind of rolling out as we have the availability of staff able to provide this training?
Yeah, I would say it's the latter, but I would say that there's always going to be demand for these types of trainings, not only in schools that haven't received it, but as the existing schools also bring on more people. Yes, they can, once they go through the trainings, they're going to be able to train within themselves, but schools are always going to want the highest quality training, and that's at the source.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Uni. Representative Erickson, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Uni, do you know to what extent the PBIS schools are linking with like county social services or other agencies so that we have this seamless operation?
Mr. Rudy.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, that's a great question. Earlier last year, we did start the process of trying to look into which schools did engage with PBIS and, for example, had school and mental health grants.
Right.
We did find that was a pretty heavy lift in terms of finding that information. If that is the wish of the committee, we can try to take a look at that again to see where there are crossovers for programming. But that would take coordination not only with DHS but also with the counties and the school districts on an individual level. So we can start to kind of take a look at it. I know that in short order, we could maybe get like a snapshot of a couple counties, but the statewide effort might take a significant amount of time.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just bring this up. I don't just bring this up, but in meeting with superintendents this morning, maybe their concern is more about having staff available at the county level for mental health services, maybe more so than the behavior, because they want that seamless coordination going on. And I think that's maybe something we have to look to for the future. Not that we can add social workers for the county from this committee, but that there needs to be this relationship going on. And I think that is an important service we can provide our schools.
Mr. Rooney.
Madam Chair, I think, you know, with what we heard from the SchoolLink Mental Health Grant information from THS, we're always looking to improve the effectiveness of our programming. And if that can be improved by coordinating with other programming that's in the school, whether it be out of this committee's purview or under MDE with MDH, DHS, DPS, we're always looking for ways to improve that. Sometimes it just takes more coordination amongst the agencies. Sometimes it does take actual authorization from the legislature. But I know as we engage with more discussion around school safety as the session goes on, I think those things will come to light and can certainly go back to staff and look where we can provide information around where crossover currently exists.
Thank you. Other questions from PBIS or other at this time? All right, so why don't we go ahead and then talk about compensatory revenue and the Safe Schools Levy revenue.
All right. Madam Chair, committee members, the last topic, as the chair mentioned, Safe School Levy and compensatory revenue as they are as they're used at the local level with areas of mental health services. We did an analysis of where districts overall statewide, we had some statewide numbers on where they use the funding for hiring on school support personnel whose core functions would touch upon mental health services. We can't say that everything they're doing, and as you can see, a school counselor, not everything they're doing would impact mental health services as we classically look at it, but these are the personnel that we think would be the most positioned to have an impact on mental health in a school. So Safe Schools Levy, the statewide levy is approximately about $34.6 million. It's $36 per pupil in a district, and intermediates get $15 per pupil more for safe school activities. This allows districts to levy to keep students and staff safe. It can be expended on police liaison services, drug abuse prevention, gang-resistant training, school security, crime prevention, and counseling. The levy covered the following personnel for fiscal 17, $1.5 million for school counselors, roughly $211,000 for school psychologists, $1.5 million for school social workers, and $23.5 million for behavioral aides. Compensatory revenue, that's statewide. It's approximately $550 million. As you know, it's calculated as a concentration formula based on each site's count of students who are eligible for free or reduced price lunch. At least 50% must be used at the site that generated the funding, so there's a 50% flexibility of use. And Madam Chair, as you know, added on last year, there's a percentage that has to be used for extended time activities, ramping up to 3.5% plus a percentage change in a formula from fiscal 19 and forward. This has to be used. The core uses of compensatory revenue has to be used for services for those that are lagging behind in academic progress. It can be used for instruction, adding teachers or aides, providing staff development, parental involvement programs, and purchasing materials. And for the personnel that were hired that we identified in fiscal 17 under this statewide was $9.4 million for school social workers, $1 million for school psychologists, and $19.8 million on school counselors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rooney. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rooney, what is our ratio now of counselor to pupil?
Mr. Rooney.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have the updated numbers off the top of my head. I do know that in the nation we are very well near the bottom. I'm not sure if any of my colleagues or any of our professional staff for the committee would have that ratio We can certainly work together to try to provide that as soon as possible. But I know that the ratio still remains quite high or low, but however you want to phrase it, many students per one counselor.
Yeah, Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to get that information.
And we will get that. I know there was we have a guesstimate up here that it's maybe 650 to 1, but I'm not sure that that's accurate, so we'll try to get accurate numbers and provide that to the entire committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the compensatory revenue and how it was used, you have dollar figures there. Do you have a breakdown of what $9.4 million for school social workers got us? How many social workers did it get us? The $1 million for school psychologists, how many psychologists? And the $19.8 million on school counselors, how many counselors did that get us?
Mr. Rooney.
Madam Chair, Representative, sure. I figured this question would come. It's natural. I was looking down at the figures, going, I know there's going to be this question, which is a very natural question. We can go back and take a look. I'm not sure if my colleague would have any insight. I would imagine that these dollars weren't always buying the full FTE. I imagine there was partial funding and things like that, or ancillary funding around that counselor, but it was just coded as attached to that. But we can go back and try to take a look to see what we can find to get more definite numbers.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Uni, just a question. Do you know, I mean, obviously, the Safe Schools levy money, I think a lot of that does go to school resource officers, and you've got the amount of money being expended for counselors, psychologists, social workers, and that. Do you know if that is a correct assumption that most of it, if it's going to personnel, might be going for school resource officers? Or
I haven't done that analysis, and you know the data that we pulled was centered around those that would have a connection or nexus with mental health. Again, we can easily pull that. I think that would be coded in UFARS, and we could pull that information.
Okay. All right, and that might be actually a more appropriate question for a hearing next week. So,
well, Madam Chair, we will have that prepared.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Let's see, other questions? I'm going to throw this one out because I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask, or I know the representatives from the Department of Human Services mentioned they, Mr. Burrett, could not be here today. So if we need to loop back to them with this question, they said they'd provide any information we needed to the committee. But so we know that the grants, the mental health grants that go from human services to counties or to providers in the counties, and then schools can seek services to that. How do the schools apply to be able to get those services? I had a question from a group of superintendents I met with this morning, and I actually didn't know the answer to that. So do you know how the schools actually, is there an application process through MDE, or did they go directly to the county, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, I think your intuition was correct about Mr. Burdick's presence. Okay. I would defer to him in terms of the exact process there, and I wouldn't want to misrepresent what the process is.
Okay. And okay, so maybe Ms. Aberholden does know, and we could have you. If there's any other questions for Mr. Uni right now, why don't we do that? Otherwise, we could bring Ms. Aberholden, and we had another testifier from yesterday who we couldn't get to, the school psychologist, come down, and then we can morph to them. Any other questions for Mr. Uni right now? All right. So, Ms. Aberholden, thanks you so much. I'll let you just go ahead and introduce yourself, and you can start with that question and then launch into your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. So the schools actually can't apply for the grants. It is actually the mental health providers, not the counties. It just happened that yesterday you had a county that is a mental health provider, but that's rare. And then they have to actually show that they have an agreement with the school in order to apply for the grant. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes. So the providers have an agreement with a school, then they apply for the grant.
That's correct.
Through the county. Gotcha. Okay, so the schools would need to reach out, create an agreement with a local provider, and then they would have a possibility. So I'm assuming that there's more requests or more relationships perhaps than the funding can allow for.
That is correct. We're not able to meet all of the needs and all of the applicants.
Okay. All right. Well, that's helpful. Thank you very much for that. And now please go ahead and offer your testimony.
Well, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about children's mental health. When we think about the mental health of children, we're really talking about the achievement of developmental and emotional milestones, healthy social development, and effective coping skills so that they have a positive quality of life and can function well at home, in school, and in their communities. Mental health is a continuum, so you have children with good mental health on one hand and children with a mental illness on the other, and, of course, a lot of stuff in between. And there are many diagnoses in kids, including anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, eating disorders, ADHD, ADD, autism spectrum, et cetera. Mental illnesses are actually a young person's illness. Half of all adults began experiencing symptoms by the age of 14 and 75% by the age of 26. A little over 20% of our children have a mental illness with a range of severity. The suicide rate in Minnesota for 2016 included 9 children, ages 10 to 14, 39, ages 15 to 19, and 64 young adults between the ages of 20 and 24. There are studies showing that the prevalence rates are increasing from, say, the 1990s, and with more children than ever needing hospitalization. We know that distress among our children is increasing, although we don't really know all the reasons why. Certainly social media, bullying, genetics, trauma, historical trauma, toxic stress from high poverty situations and unstable housing, and then, of course, genetics play a role as well. I will say that our children's mental health system isn't broken. It just was never built. And with more children seeking treatment and children with more complex needs, we simply aren't meeting their needs. Overall, in Minnesota, we went from having about 9,946 mental health kids, you know, issues in the emergency room in 2007 to over 19,000 in 2016. So a lot more children are ending up in the emergency room. We don't have enough options, and these children are, frankly, often sent home from the emergency room. We don't have quite, it's about 150 children's psychiatric beds in the metro area and 42 in greater Minnesota. We have about 636 children's residential treatment beds, 70% of them in greater Minnesota. We are hoping to build a new level of treatment between hospital level and kids residential. It's called psychiatric residential treatment facilities. The legislature authorized 150 beds. Those are just coming online, and, of course, we have to make sure that city councils allow them to be built in their communities. So early identification and treatment, rather than simply building hospitals and residential treatment centers, actually have to be part of the solution. And we need to go to where the children are, in childcare, in schools, in pediatricians' offices, to eliminate all the barriers to treatment. If we think of starting from the very beginning, we need to support babies and mothers in developing strong bonds, especially when the mother has a mental illness, has had a lot of trauma in her life, or is experiencing postpartum depression. And that's where mother-baby treatment programs come in, home visiting programs, but all of those are underfunded. We have children who are being kicked out of child care programs, and this, of course, is where early childhood mental health consultation and multi-generational mental health programs come in, both, again, woefully underfunded. And then we have our schools, where children spend a large majority of their time. And our schools see children who have been impacted by the trauma they've experienced, children who simply have not learned to regulate their emotions, and children who are developing a mental illness. And all of these children need help, and without it, often do poorly in school and in life. And programs provided in the school are really key to supporting children's mental health. This includes teacher training on the early warning signs of mental illness, along with trauma, fetal alcohol, de-escalation, and other topics. And we were the first state in the country to require that type of training. Staff development, as you've heard, is also really important. And suicide prevention, so that teachers know what to do and say when a student comes forward. And, of course, we have a bill this session, Representative Anselmo, to fund online suicide prevention training to make it easier to access. PBIS improves social, emotional, and academic outcomes for all students, including students with disabilities and students from underrepresented groups. And yet we don't have PBIS in every school. School support personnel, school social workers, psychologists, nurses, and counselors are often the first line of defense, talking to students and families when problems arise. And yet we don't have enough of them in our schools. And school-linked mental health programs are critical. And after hearing the testimony yesterday, I just want to add a few things. The purpose was to eliminate barriers to access. That includes taking off of work once a week for 22 weeks, transportation, distance to where the provider is, navigating the children's mental health system, time out of school, all of those things. And children are referred by everyone. It could be a parent, a teacher, school support personnel, and it's actually open to all children who need it, regardless of if they're special ed or regular ed, if they're insured or underinsured or insured. And the funding comes basically from insurance, public and private, and then the grant funding. And so it's really graded funding, which really helps it be more of a sustainable program. We don't expect our schools to provide mental health treatment, clinical treatment, which is why the grants go to the mental health providers and not the schools. And again, I just want to note, you had an anomaly yesterday having a county provider, because that's not typical at all. So they were really coming here as a provider and not as a county. The provider, again, can bill all the different types of insurance. And the other thing that happens, what parents really wanted when we were developing this, is there's a firewall between the educational and the healthcare records. And families really wanted that because they wanted to be sure that those records were private. And the other thing that happens through this program is because they're mental health providers, they can continue to provide treatment in the summer and when school is out of session. And school-linked programs actually build on the important work of school support personnel, and they take that next step in terms of being able to diagnose and provide clinical treatment. Many school support personnel, not all but many, are not licensed as mental health professionals. There is a difference, and they each have a different type of scope of practice, so we actually need all of them, and one can't necessarily replace the other. We've had 10 years of successful operation of this program, and yet it's still not in every school, every school district, or every school building, and it's really underfunded. We've been asked by Florida to actually spent a lot of time last week explaining this program because they would like to replicate it there because they really saw how important and effective it is. You know, so often I hear, so what can we do for our children? What can we do about the children's mental health system? And I guess I could just say, finish it. Fund the programs that work. That includes funding early childhood mental health consultation, helping them before they ever get to school, continue the teacher training, especially suicide prevention, create more trauma-informed schools through professional development, fund PBIS, fund school support personnel so we have enough social workers, nurses, psychologists, and counselors, educate youth on mental health and mental illness, support resiliency training, social-emotional learning. Don't suspend children, especially in K through 3. They need our help and not punishment. Enforce mental health parity so that children with private insurance have coverage for their mental health needs as they would for any other health care concern. And address workforce shortages so that we have enough people to actually work with children. And lastly, all these systems must work together to support every child having good mental health so that they are successful in life. Again, I want to thank you for taking the time today and yesterday to really talk about children's mental health, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Averholden. Great information, and thank you so much for the advocacy work you do on this important topic. A couple questions I had. One is keying off kind of your last statements, the building a system that kind of works seamlessly. One of the stats that was mentioned yesterday by one of our testifiers really kind of caught me off guard, which is that I think it was like 45% of the children that present to maybe a school social worker or a psychologist or something, 45% have not had any mental health counseling or treatment at all before, but they were presenting with pretty severe symptoms or disturbances. I'm wondering, I mean, I'm assuming most parents take their kids to the doctor for checkups, you know, annually and that. Are pediatricians in that keyed in to be looking for some of these things or asking the right questions of parents? Because it just struck me that, you know, how things would suddenly be appearing at school, but there would be nothing before. Or is it more a case of maybe the parents not knowing where to go to get their children help, and so then school is the natural place to seek that?
Madam Chair, I think it's a couple of things. So one is, depending on the age of the child, if it's your first child or whatever, you might not know what actually normal development is. With teenagers, frankly, in particular, it's hard to know whether are these the symptoms of a mental illness or is this just someone being a teenager? And we really talk about the length of time and intensity in terms of that. We actually just had a meeting this morning over with some senators with the University of Minnesota with a bill that would actually create funding for pediatricians in their residency program. They often feel very unequipped, ill-equipped to actually address some of these children's mental health issues, not knowing when they should actually tell a parent, yes, you should be worried about this, and here's what you can do. And so this would be a way to really do that. Pediatricians generally feel like they don't get enough training on children's mental health. We don't have enough child psychiatrists. We've actually not had enough of them since President Eisenhower. It was in his mental health report that we had a shortage of child psychiatrists. We haven't fixed it yet. And so we need to make sure that pediatricians actually get that additional training so that they can help and so that only the most serious and complex cases go to a child psychiatrist.
Thank you. That's very good information. The other question I was wondering about, we talked about, you mentioned workforce shortages, and this came up again at a meeting with some superintendents that, you know, we really don't have providers in our community or close proximity that we could partner with to try to provide services, and talked about particularly a shortage of school social workers. Mm-hmm. What can you put any context around that for us and any suggestions for how we try to address that? Because we can offer funding in that, but if the professionals aren't in the workforce, that's another problem.
Madam Chair, one of the issues is really school forgiveness loans, loan forgiveness programs, which you actually opened up to mental health professionals back in, I want to say, 2016. And a lot of people have gone to that program to help. But the other problem is you have to have clinical training. And many insurance companies actually won't pay for a clinical trainee for social work, whereas they might for any other kind of healthcare professional. So that makes it hard to actually provide those training spots. So we've heard that that's one of the larger issues, that people are interested in this type of work. But if you can't get the clinical training, you can't get your license, and so then you've just spent a whole lot of money on education that isn't going to help you in the profession.
All right, thank you. Also good information. All right, we have several members with questions, so I'm going to turn to them. Representative Anselmo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sue, I just wanted to give you first a thank you for all that you've done. You know, the 30 years I've been around the mental health world and leading the Bipolar Support Alliance and the Mental Health Association, you know, your reputation and your work you know, proceeds, and you've done a great job. It seems, you know, so often that we talk about helping mental health and we have a hard time doing that. And I know that, you know, we do fund some things and we look at, you know, private organizations to do that. And I've, you know, spent a lot of time trying to raise money. It's not easy. So we need to do something bigger and bolder. So I appreciate you getting that going. I know that I'll be offering up a bill later on about suicide prevention and getting teachers. We need those sort of first responders, those people that are out there that are really touching and seeing the kids. To work on it there, and it's a challenge. So we'll talk more about that later. I am curious about the potential funding, if you're prepared to offer that up, that you would need to make this part of the program work. Thank you.
Ms. Everholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Anselmo, it's about $270,000 to fund the online suicide prevention training for a two-year period that would cover every school in Minnesota, about $40 per school. So pretty inexpensive and makes it much more easier. We actually, NAMI does a lot of it's called QPR, one-hour suicide prevention training for schools. And so it's very hard for them, though, to get all the teachers or at least teachers in a building there together to have that 1 hour. It's a lot of time. And so this way they can just go online and do it very easily. And about 30-some schools have been doing it so far and really have appreciated it and think it's very well done.
Madam Chair, so how about the school psychologist program in terms of what kind of funding do you need for that?
Senator Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative Selmo, for the school support personnel, I would actually kind of kick that back to some of the other organizations who have talked about what kind of funding would be needed, but I don't actually have that information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, thank you. I just want to say thank you for your advocacy, your work, your constant appearance here at the legislature. It really has made a difference.
Thank you.
in how we look at this work and servicing our kids in schools. But I have a question for you around mental health. You know, I was looking at the documents yesterday that talked about 58% of communities of color are not getting service. And I know in many of those communities, there were mental health, you know, it's not something that many parents want to connect with their children. So I'm just wondering, how do you engage parents in this conversation?
Ms. Everholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, it is absolutely a difficult one. We do parent education, and for parents of children, particularly in culturally specific communities, we don't call it mental illness. We call it challenging behaviors as a way.
What's the word?
Challenging behaviors. Mm-hmm. As a way to get people into the conversation about what's actually going on. The other thing that we've seen is as we've developed a more culturally diverse workforce in terms of mental health professionals, particularly through SchoolLinked, that there's that trust there that can help. And a change that you all made last year, that you could do a brief diagnostic assessment before you did a full-blown one, allowed us the time for mental health professionals to connect and to talk with families before actually kind of going through all those somewhat invasive questions, in a sense. And so we've seen that as helping as well. And the biggest thing we've seen through SchoolLinked is it's actually helping bridge that disparity gap that we've seen with kids in the past for kids of color. Because, again, they're in the school, they're trusted a little bit more, and they look like them. And so that makes it easier for families to connect as well. But I absolutely agree there's, in some languages, there isn't the word mental illness, and so that becomes even a larger barrier in terms of accessing the treatment that people need.
Yeah.
Representative Moran.
It is a stigma that, you know, many parents don't want to take on. And I heard you use the mental health professional, that language again. So I'm just really curious about how you're speaking to parents when they have behavior problems and whether or not we're saying to them something's mentally wrong with your kids. Because that is what they hear. My second question is, you know, you made a statement earlier about we shouldn't suspend children K through 3, but of course it's happening. It also happens in pre-K that kids are being suspended from school. They need our help and not our punishment. I would agree with you. And you spoke a little bit about trauma-informed and practices. So is with the social workers or the professionals in the school, are they working towards, you know, creating more trauma-informed environments and looking at ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and how that impacts the behavior of kids when they are inundated with maybe abuse, neglect, or drugs in the home, or there's many ACEs that impacts kids in their lives and how they grow and develop in their brain. Is that something that, you know, the professionals are looking at?
Ms. Everholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, we're seeing a much greater awareness among schools, school support personnel, even mental health professionals getting more training in that area. And as we learn more about the brain and actually, you know, what happens when that occurs to a child, that it really can change the structure of the brain. You know, people are saying things like instead of, you know, what's wrong with you, what happened to you,
mm-hmm.
to really try to figure that out. And we've had just even this fall, I take a lot of calls from parents. And we had a mom whose child was actually in a private school, kindergartner, African-American boy. And he was sent home several times a week. Well, he actually had some pretty high anxiety, and so when he actually went to a public school, actually the teachers had a lot more training around trauma-informed care and about how do I accommodate for this kid, and he hasn't been sent home once. And so they were able to figure out strategies that to help him learn himself how to calm down, you know, those kinds of things. And so we've seen a sea change, I believe, in the schools really starting to understand this. Not that we don't have a long way to go. But I really think when we look at those little kids aren't bad. They're not, you know, purposely acting out. They're acting out because they don't have the words to describe what's going on to them. They don't have the tools to calm themselves down. And so we really do have to teach them and help them support that. And the one thing about the ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences, is what that study actually showed us is that some children had the same amount of ACEs and were okay. And so it really is about how do we, because things are going to happen. You can't protect children from everything, tornadoes, death, car accidents, all those things. So how do we help all children be resilient so that they can come back from things that happen to them? I mean, certainly trying to prevent ACEs from happening, but the goal of the study was to really figure out how can we help all children be resilient.
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. And so we are in an era where there's new research out there around ACEs and around how to create trauma-informed environments, recognizing that many families are challenged with many issues or problems or encounters that is often, you know, outside of their ability to control the factors. But those factors impact kids. And so because there is more research, especially around brain, you know, because sometimes we look at just the behavior, and now we know it is that actually it's the brain, those, you know, synaptics and neurons that are changing based on those encounters that they are having, that it's not just about behavior, but something is really happening developmentally, I mean, with the brain. And that we can begin to, because we are smarter, to respond more of a smarter way where we're not just, you know, seeing bad kids, trouble kids, and we need to remove them, but how do we support them so that they can be the best that they can be and they can grow up to be functional adults that are capable of taking care of themselves and their family and are contributing to our states. So my hope is that as we work within the whole mental health arena, that we are looking at how we are creating results that really create better outcomes for our kids in a way that look at environments, you know, and we're looking at schools now. And so how can those schools become more trauma-informed environments, you know? Something as simple as, you know, a kid who's growing up being abused in a home and in the classroom where kids are required to raise their hand, where a kid who's being hit all the time just raising their hand flares up emotions that may cause them to react in a negative way or to run out the classroom. So it's just really important that, you know, as we are partnering with schools, that we help, you know, principals and teachers and paraprofessionals, just not the professionals who deal with behaviors, how to respond and how to look beyond a kid and saying what is wrong with you, but we are saying to those kids what is happening to you. And then we see solutions differently. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our testifier a moment ago said that our school counselors are part of our first line of defense. And I asked a question earlier about our ratio of counselor to student, and I've been handed that information, so I wanted to share it with you. This is from the American School Counselors Association. The latest report shows that in Minnesota, we have one counselor to 723 students. The national average is one counselor to 482 students. Their recommendation is one counselor to 250 students. And currently, we are fourth worst in the country in our ratio of counselors to students. And, you know, I think a big part of us trying to fix some of these problems is, you know, first identifying them, and we need to have the right amount of people on that first line of defense.
Thank you. I think that's a very important part of this conversation. So thanks for sharing that with us. All right. I think what I'd like to do now, and Mr. Aberholden, if you want to stay in case we have more questions, but Mr. Romstead with the school psychologist. So I have you as our final testifier from yesterday. Thank you so much for coming back to be with us again today, and I apologize for that delay, but well, glad you're here.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Representatives. I just want to say thanks for having me back. It's a tremendous pleasure, honor to exercise my civic duty today in speaking to you. So,
thank you. Please, so just go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and we welcome your testimony.
My name is Carl Romstead. I am a school psychologist and licensed special education director in the state of Minnesota. I'm also part of the Minnesota School Psych Association Board. So a lot of times when people think about school psychologists, they don't really know what to think. They think we're school counselors, and that's not true. School psychologists have a tremendously unique job. We are mental and behavioral health specialists and providers, and we're also educational psychologists, where we're looking a lot at measurements in special education, but we're not here to talk about that today. We're going to talk about the behavioral health portion. I'd like to touch on three different points today in the short amount of time that I have. One is our role as behavioral and mental health professionals, our resources for further professional development, which is huge. We always have to learn, as well as our training and shortage of professionals in our discipline. We've been hearing a lot about shortages, so I don't want to kick that dead horse, but you have to hear it. Okay. I did hand out some information yesterday to you. If you had a chance to read it, I hope there was enough. So, but I'll let you refer to that if you want to. So the initial part, what does a school psychologist do in terms of behavioral health needs? And this is what we do in the following ways. We hear and consult with teachers and staff. All right, we're there, like the school counselor, the school, we're a school resource to hear any concerns that a teacher may have. We'll listen. We'll also do that with students at a different level of support, the multi-tiered system of support. So there's the first level, second level, and third level, which is special education. We're there at each one of those areas. We also support outside referrals to trained and experienced licensed mental health professionals. We support it. Okay, in the state of Minnesota, we cannot call a doctor and say, I think you need to speak to this student. We need to go through the parents. Now, we talked yesterday about having trained mental health professionals, legal mental health professionals in the schools, and that would be tremendously huge because we are theoretical mental health professionals, but legal mental health professionals, we are not in many cases, and I think it's important that everyone knows that. So I say again, I cannot pick up the phone and call a doctor and say you need to speak to this individual in most cases. Unless you have your PhD, I believe you can. However, I won't go there because I don't know the answer. beyond this, the school psychologists in Minnesota have a variety of resources to help guide them and educate them regarding mental health in student populations. Like I said, continuing development and education is just key for every single person. We have the Minnesota State School or Minnesota School Psych Association. Every year we have, you know, we have training, we have professional development, and we do the best we can there, hitting hot topics. We have the National Association of School Psychologists, which is tremendously bigger, and we hit a lot of different topics there. And we also have the International School Psych Association, which gives us a worldly perspective on this. The United States is getting more and more diverse every year. We need to think about the rest of the world when we talk about mental health services. MSPA, Minnesota School Psych Association, is also in connection with the three major schools to prepare our school psychologists in Minnesota, which is the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, University of Minnesota Mankato, and Minnesota Moorhead. So we're always talking to them about training and the shortage of school psychologists. We talk to the neighboring states as well, like Wisconsin. So one thing MSPA really wanted me to make sure to hit is we want to ensure that there is a pathway for licensing for all school psychologists, regardless of their background. Some school psychologists come from different backgrounds, or they've taken a more unique path to get their education. But getting their licensure can be a bit more tricky in the state of Minnesota. We're very picky. So MSPA would like to work with them in doing that. We want to provide leadership to the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board and guidance on framing licensure tiers. Okay, that's one part. Like I said, some of us have non-traditional backgrounds, but are absolutely capable of being an outstanding psychologist, okay? And yesterday, before I open this up to questions, you asked one of the people if they had a wish or if something could change, what would that be? And I don't know if that applies here. And Madam Chair and Representatives, we just got done talking about different mentalities in terms of mental health. And I've been doing this for 7 years, so I am not tremendously experienced. But I've been there and I've seen enough to know this. I've served a lot of diverse learners, a lot of different culturally and linguistically diverse students. And when I went through my education to get my degree, I don't remember much training in mental health outside of a Western mentality. I just don't remember that. There wasn't much at all. As a matter of fact, in one of our mental health classes, learning how to treat and help people outside of the Western culture, we watched Gran Torino, and that was supposed to suffice. So if someone said, what could you do to make things different, I would say we need to start looking at mental health from a different perspective, from a non-Western perspective. Many of my students' parents, as we've been talking about, will hear mental health and they will shun it. They will walk away. They don't want it. I think it's going to take more than just diverse professionals. I think we need to diversify how we train our people to deliver mental health services. Because like I said, we see it through a Western lens, and I think that needs to change. Minnesota is diverse enough to be significant and socialized enough to make a change in this matter. So I think I've spoken enough. I don't want to repeat myself. Madam Chair, representatives, I'll take questions if you have any.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rumstead. And again, I appreciate very much your remarks and being here again today. One quick question, then I'm going to turn over to Representative Dabney. But when you were talking about the licensure, and I was just conferring with staff to make sure I heard this right, does PELSBY or the new Professional Educator Licensure Standards Board, is that the licensing entity for school psychologists?
Yes, I believe that in Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you. Just want to make sure that was clear. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for these 2 days of hearings. It's valuable for all of us to focus in on this. A lot of the conversation today has and yesterday has been appropriately on the individual level.
Yep.
You know, school counselors, school psychologists working with individual students. In looking at your materials, there's some conversation about social-emotional learning.
Yep.
The larger climate and context of the school that I think is also important. Can you speak to that and to the school psychologist's role in facilitating, supporting, guiding, consulting on social-emotional learning initiatives in schools, please?
So Representative, I'm going to ask, are we, Madam Chair, Representative, are we talking about the PBIS sort of creating a culture of positive behavior or...
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. PBIS is part of it, but I'm also thinking just more broadly, what is the school climate like for all learners? And PBIS would be one example, but I'm sure there are other strategies that can be used to create a positive climate in a school that, yes, rewards good behavior, but affirms different cultures and things like that that can help hold a kid?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I understand the question.
Thank you.
So in most schools, in all schools, actually, the climate goes like this. There are different tiers through the multi-tiered systems of support academically and behaviorally. The first tier, which is the majority of our students, it will be just a positive school climate and a school culture of positive behaviors. That's also looking at students and how they're behaving, making referrals if the students are behaving in a way that may not be the most normal. Tier 2, now, is not special education, like I said, but it is an elevated level of support. A good example of Tier 2 would be if we have a student that is having a lot of bad days. Staff notices it. We notice it. We could implement something like check-in, check-out, which would be when a student would come to school. Now, this is without a parent signature, mind you. This is all general ed. A student would come to school. We would ask that student, how is your day going to be today? With a designated check-in person. At the end of the day, that child would check out, how was your day? If the student didn't have a good day, we would give sort of off-the-cuff mental health services, you could call it, and say, why do you think your day wasn't good? What could we do to have a better day? If the student wants to talk about what's going on at home, how can we just have a better week, et cetera? It would then go to, if that student doesn't make progress, possibly to Tier 3, where a referral is made and we would maybe do some mental health screeners on that student and see what else is going on. Does that answer your question, Representative, Madam Chair?
I think it helps.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Other questions for Mr. Rumstead or if you have them for Ms. Aggerholden? All right. And actually, we do probably need to devote some time to our other set topic for today. So thank you both so much for being here. Thank you to all of the testifiers.
Madam Chair, Representatives, thank you very much.
Thank you. And I wanted to also mention Mr. Rick Heller had some information that he wanted the committee members to have. So that information was copied and put in your folder. So just wanted to draw your attention to it. All right, and so we're going to now turn, it's not a very elegant transition, but to the subject of fiscal transparency and accountability overview. with the department, but I should do a little housekeeping. We forgot to take care of minutes yesterday, and so now we're backlogged. So Representative Wills, if you wanted to move, I have minutes for February 22nd and also for February 27th in your packets.
Madam Chair, I would move the minutes for February 22nd and February 27th.
All right. So both sets of minutes have been moved. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Minutes are approved. Thank you very much, Representative Wills. All right. And so, again, we will move to discussion of fiscal transparency. And some of these, again, as this discussion is stemming from ESSA, the changes made at the federal level that we are working on our plan of complying with that. And so we have Dr. Melcher and Mr. Keith here with us from the department today. So welcome, gentlemen. Whoever wants to start, please go ahead. And if you'd each just introduce yourself so we have that for the record. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Finance Director at the Department of Education.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Greg Keith. I'm Chief Academic Officer at the Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm going to do a brief introduction just around some of the information around fiscal transparency and in terms of the accountability, just some general information on how we monitor district compliance on numerous programs. And then Tom's going to go into a lot more detail in terms of compliance and monitoring compliance. So I'm going to kind of be the prelude, and then he's going to be the meat of the presentation. So specifically, we understood that there might have been a request for information around fiscal transparency and new requirements under the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA. ESSA has a long list of items that states are required to publicly report via what's called a state report card. We've maintained a report card for numerous years and are currently working to update the report card to be in compliance with ESSA by the beginning of the next school year, which is our deadline. Specifically in the area of fiscal transparency, a new requirement in ESSA is states must report the per pupil expenditures of both districts and schools for all three of federal, state, and local funds. Specifically, the language of the law calls out personnel expenditures versus non-personnel expenditures. And what's not on your slide but is also in the law that we've been talking about as a pretty significant change is these expenditures that are reported have to be actual expenditures versus average expenditures. And so that's a pretty significant change. Unlike many of the new requirements in ESSA for publicly reporting, the fiscal data does not have to begin to be reported until school year 18-19, specifically December 2019. So that'll be sort of our second phase of revamping our school report card. But within what we're required to do under ESSA, or beyond what we're required to do under ESSA, many of you have heard us talk about our ESSA work and our stakeholder engagement and our consolidated state plan, and you've heard us talk about how one of the overarching themes and priorities for Minnesota through the construction and implementation of this new plan is a priority on equity and a priority on addressing inequities. We very much feel like fiscal transparency and where resources are spent in schools and districts is an equity issue. So it's one of our goals as we implement ESSA to actually move beyond what's required in the ESSA law that I just talked about. And that involves several different aspects. Number one, we currently report per pupil expenditures. I'm not sure that the average community member could understand what we report. And so one of our priorities is to take what we're reporting and plain language it and explain it so that it's understandable by educators, parents, community members. So that's one of our huge priorities. We want to move beyond expenditures to also let community members know what are the sources of funds as well as expenditures for schools and districts. So what's the money flowing in, what are the resources flowing in, as well as what are the resources flowing out. Specifically, we have interest in looking and sharing teacher salary information. This is a huge area of equity in terms of which teachers are teaching which students. Do our low income, our students of color, our special education students, our English learners, are they taught by teachers who are making as much or as veteran or as valued as other teachers? So that's a particular area of interest for us. We've currently, in our phase two of ESSA stakeholder engagement, we're looking at three different areas, one of which is public reporting. So we're really in the very preliminary stages of this in terms of engaging with stakeholders around what information do you want, around what information, how do you want that information provided so that it's understandable? So how can we present it transparently and in an understandable fashion? Again, we're very early in that. We do have a stakeholder group established. They've met two times now. We've conducted focus groups with students, with parents, and with educators, and we're just now beginning to compile some of that information that we're getting from focus groups. So we're still very, very early in that. So if you have some specific questions about that, my response might be it's really too early to tell, or thank you for that feedback. We'll bring that back into the pool of information that we've collected. One other feature of ESSA and our implementation of ESSA that I did want to call out as relevant to this fiscal transparency and this question of equity is under both World's Best Workforce and ESSA and our supports for identified schools and districts, one of the most important changes and one of the largest changes that we're making is in order to develop their school improvement plan and in order to prioritize strategies in their school improvement plan, districts and schools must look at what are the needs of this particular school or this particular district and what are resource inequities in several different areas in order to ensure that there's equitable resource allocation to all schools within a district, especially the lower performing or underperforming schools. So that's a very explicit piece of our school improvement supports that's required under ESSA. The final observation I would make there is that Minnesota, per ESSA, that's only required for your lowest performing schools, but in our ESSA plan, actually, it's required for all schools that are identified, whether they're identified for comprehensive support and improvement or targeted support and improvement. So our state made a very deliberate decision to go above and beyond because of our prioritization of equity and that's what stakeholders wanted. So, so introducing the conversation about district compliance and how we monitor and hold districts accountable for many of the different funding streams or resources that they receive. I'm just going to, again, speak really generally to how we look at monitoring district compliance, and then Tom's going to bring a lot more specificity to that conversation. Generally, we think of monitoring or of compliance monitoring through the lens of six different overarching strategies that we can use to monitor and ensure compliance. You see those listed on the slide. First of all, and I'm going to briefly go through them just to explain what the terminology we're using is. First of all is program guidance. Program guidance is generally some sort of written resource from the document that references best practice. And so really the slant of program guidance is to ensure that a program is implemented or resources are utilized in a way that's best going to support student learning, improve teaching, whatever might be the focus of the resources. I'm going to skip down and I'm going to mention program compliance review criteria. We think of that a little bit differently. It's very similar to program guidance in terms of being some sort of written document or some sort of written resource that is coming from policy or from law. But this is a lot more focused, not on best practice as program guidance, but it's a lot more focused primarily on what's law say you have to do? What do you need to do to stay out of trouble and out of the newspaper? So to stay in compliance with law. So it's generally a lot more technical in nature versus program guidance would be a lot more educational, let's say, in nature. We believe that we can monitor and ensure compliance probably best through strong technical assistance, because you can look at a lot of these documents, you can provide a lot of these documents, but if you're on the ground shoulder to shoulder answering questions and assisting as programs are being implemented, then you really know what's going on in terms of that program and what they're struggling with, what they're spending funds on, what the results are. So technical assistance we see as one of the key leverage points in terms of monitoring. And we define technical assistance as anything from coaching to answering a phone call to going on site, you know, to problem solving, to facilitating planning meetings. For almost any program, there's an annual application that's submitted and that's reviewed by the department that does generally include a budget and many times includes some sort of strategic action plan or some sort of work plan to let us know what the district is doing with the resources. Finally, periodically and more on the back end, we also facilitate on-site or desk program reviews. These can be very general and look at all aspects of a program, or they can be targeted and look at one specific aspect or one or two specific aspects of a large program. And then Tom's going to speak more, especially to the fiscal audits, which are more not necessarily facilitated by program staff versus school finance staff, so kind of our accounting experts. I was going to go through an example of our federal Title I program and just how they use these six different strategies to monitor compliance. I can definitely go back and do that, but I think for now I'm going to pass to Tom in the interest of moving us along. And then if we have time and there is a specific question, I can come back to this slide and talk and give a specific programmatic example on how they utilize these six different strategies.
All right. Thank
Madam
you,
Chair, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Keith.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Finance Director at the Department of Education. I'd like to just make one brief comment about the fiscal transparency, and then I'd like to move into a handout which I have on accountability. But with respect to fiscal transparency, I just want to point out to the committee that Minnesota does have a longstanding requirement in statute. It's Minnesota Statute 123B76. Subdivision 3, which already requires expenditure reporting by building. So we do publish that annually on the Department of Education website. We show for each building in the state what their expenditures are per pupil. The current state law does require us to break down those expenditures by program. So our report will show how much the district spends for administration versus instruction versus special education instruction versus maintenance of the building, that sort of thing. So what's changing, and our current law does also require that districts report actual salaries rather than averaging the salaries when they do the reporting by building. But what's changing in the new ESSA requirements is the requirement to break those expenditure down by funding source and to break them down between personnel expenditures and non-personnel expenditures. So one of the things we're struggling with in the early stages of doing a new report, which I think would be a lot more accessible on the report card rather than being buried in our data center, is how to merge those two requirements so we don't get an unwieldy report that's so long that the target audience finds it difficult to go through. So with that, I'd like to move to the handout that I have in your packets that's labeled Accountability for State-Funded Revenue Streams. And the first thing that I want to point out is that most of our major state funding programs, as you know, are based on pupil data and or approved expenditures. I've got a couple pages that just list our biggest programs, and you can see obviously the basic general education formula is driven by the number of students, average daily membership. Some of our other programs, operating capital is based not only on students but on building age. Referendum revenue, obviously, in addition to the number of students, we have to know what the ballot language said and what the election results were and so forth. This is just kind of giving you a listing of the major programs and what kind of data drives those programs. And for the most part, it's students and expenditures that are big drivers. So if you go to the bottom of page 2 of the handout,
you'll see what we try to do is build accountability into the data collection systems that we use to collect that the student data and the expenditure data that drives most of our funding formulas. And so our primary system for student data is called the Minnesota Automated Reporting Student System, or MARS for short. For expenditure data, we collect very detailed data on expenditures for special education programs through a system called EDRS, Electronic Data Reporting. But our primary financial reporting system is the UFAR system, Uniform Financial Accounting. And then we do have some very detailed program applications. So, for example, if you want to qualify for American Indian Education revenue, you need to submit a budget that shows what you're going to spend it on. Or the same thing with achievement integration revenue. Those applications get reviewed by program staff to make sure that they're consistent with the program requirements before they get to us in the finance department. So I'd like to say a little bit more about how we build accountability into our student system, which drives most of our funding. It's called the MARS system. For many years, we have based our funding on individual student data. That means that the first time a student touches the public school system, they get a MARS number, and they're identified with that number throughout the course of their 13 or 14 years within the public school system. Students do move around quite a bit, and we keep track of how many days each student was enrolled in each school in each district. And so we've got a lot of data. We have over a million records that we deal with every year, and some students might have 5 or 6 different records because they started out, were in one school for a month or two, and then their family moved, they went to another school. So some of the things we have to deal with are making sure if a student is reported in more than one school that we're not paying both schools for the same time. So we have a lot of edit checks built into our system. We have a web-based edit system that school districts can go through and check their data before they submit it to us in MARS. And then we do statewide edits as well, where we can cross-check across districts. We have a number of warning messages that we have in the system just to give districts a heads up. So if a district has no students that are English language learners in their entire school or their entire district, we'll give them an edit that says you might want to double-check to make sure you don't really have some English language learners. Or if there are no students in poverty, we'll let them know that. We won't kick anything out, but we'll let them know that. And then we have other edits that are more, we call them like fatal errors, where we just won't pay you. So if we have the same student, and we know it's the same student because they have the same MARS number when they go from district to district, they're reported for the same school days in two different districts, we're not going to pay both districts for those days. So our standard rule is, we pay the district that's adding the student. We quit paying the district that's dropping the student, because what that probably means to us is the district was a little slow about telling us that they left the first district. They can challenge that if they don't think that's correct. So we build in a lot of checks to make sure that we're getting good individual student data that's going to drive our general education funding formula and all of our other student funding formulas. So let me turn to the next page, and that deals with our EDRS reporting. And our largest expenditure-driven program is the special education program. And what we do with special education is we get individual data on all of the staff. So special education funding is about 95% based on salaries for teachers, paraprofessionals, other special education staff. We get reports that show the individual data for each of those teachers, what their salary is, their licensure and so forth, what their assignment is. And then we do, again, I think we have 117 different edit checks we run through that verify things like the teacher is licensed in the area that they're teaching in, so that we're not going to pay a school district for a teacher that's not properly licensed in special education. We also have a variety of edit checks on salary rates. So if they're reported as an aide and they're making $60 an hour, that's going to get kicked out, because we've had some issues in the past where a school district has a non-licensed person, they're paying them as a teacher, but they claim them as an aide so that they can get special ed funding. But you can't do that if they're working as a teacher. They need to be properly licensed. So I don't want to go through all of the details here and bore you, but I just want you to know that We do a very thorough job of editing the data as it comes in for special education on an individual staff person basis. If we have individual students that are on a contract, we also have individual information coming in on those contracts. And so we're getting all this budget data from school districts on their staffing, but we also cross-check that against the UFARS reporting that a district does. The UFARS reporting is summary-level financial data. It will tell us how much a district is spending by program area, but not based on individual teachers. So we do kind of a global cross-check to make sure that a district didn't report $10 million of expenditures in EDRS and only had $8 million of expenditures in their audited financial statement. So if the two don't line up, we're going to pay them based on the lesser of the two, which gives them a real incentive to make sure that they line up to avoid a financial penalty. So that's kind of the process we go through with expenditure-driven programs. And then I want to say a little bit more about UFARs. There are many places in law where state statute requires separate accounting for expenditures for particular program areas. They're typically categorical programs where you have said the money can only be used for certain things. And if you turn to page 5 of the handout, and actually page 6 as well, you will see a list of those different areas where the legislature has said we want to see separate accounting and tracking of this money, and if the district doesn't spend all of the money we've given them for that purpose by the end of the fiscal year, we want to make sure that they're maintaining a separate fund balance in that so that doesn't get lost in the general fund and used for something else the next year. So for each of these programs, we maintain a reserve. This is the actual code we use in MARS. So the reserve for staff development is fund balance code 403. It's kept separate from the general fund balance the district has. It can only be used for staff development activities under Minnesota Statute 122A1661. And at the end of 2017, districts had $23 million that they had received in that account that they had not yet spent. And so that's set up, and the district can only use that for staff development activities in a future year. I'm not going to go through all of these, but I just want you to know that we provide instructions to districts each year on all of the changes that get made with new legislation in terms of where they're required to account for the money separately. We don't audit all of the districts each year, but under state law, school districts are required to have an audit done by an independent CPA firm that does some spot checking of these expenditures to make sure they're following the accounting guidelines. We also provide quite a bit of training in UFARS to new business managers to make sure that they understand the UFARS manual, where there are fairly detailed descriptions of what you can use these different sources of money for. And if you turn to page 7, one other strategy that we have, again, it's based on state law, is that we audit school districts. And Minnesota Statute 127A41, subdivisions 3 and 4, give the department authority to conduct audits of the data that goes into our funding programs. And that's primarily the student data because that's where most of the money is, but we're trying to branch out and do some expenditure-based audits as well. State law requires us to do at least 25 audits per year. We've long felt that that's pretty inadequate because we have 330 school districts and 160 or 170 charter schools, so your chances of being audited if we're only doing 25 audits are like once every 20 years. So it's not as many as we would like to do, but we take that requirement seriously, and we have completed more than 25 audits in each of the past several years. I thought you might be interested in some of the summary data, and so I provided 4 years' worth of information at the bottom of the chart. So currently this year we have conducted 24 audits, of which 16 are compensatory audits and 8 are student accounting ADM audits. And the net change in state aid is $788,000 of reductions. Last year we did 41 audits, with a net change of aid being $609,000. The year before it was 49 audits with a change of $375,000. And then in fiscal 15 we had 33 audits with a net change of $4.3 million. We had a couple of really big audits in fiscal 15 that caused the numbers to be a lot higher than they typically are. But we currently have three auditors in the Department of Education that do these audits, so there's significantly more savings to the state from the audits being done financially than what the cost is to the state to employ these three individuals to do the work. In addition to the audits, and these are audits that are done in my division, Program Finance Division. In addition to the audits that we do, we also have a Compliance and Assistance Division, which is federally funded with special education dollars, and they do compliance monitoring, fiscal monitoring. And they have a different kind of a program focus, and Greg talked about the different purposes of monitoring, and so they tend not to be doing an audit where they take money away. Instead, they go out and they'll say, you've got some procedural problems with the way you're accounting for your purchase of equipment or things like that. And so they're more providing assistance to districts so that they can be more compliant with law. So when I had our compliance and assistance director summarize what they've been doing over the years, it's, fiscal 17, they had 535 corrective action plans. So they're basically saying, here's what you're doing. This is where we think your procedures need to be improved, and please go forward and do that. There's a typo here. It says 11 reviews in 2015. I think that should say 111 reviews. So they've been pretty consistent. One thing they do in our fiscal monitoring section that I think adds to their efficiency is they're able to do a lot of paper reviews where they will ask districts to provide information on what their procedures and processes were, some of their data. They can review those in the office and not spend all their time behind the car wheel driving around the state. So I think they're a pretty efficient operation. So, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but that's an overview of the fiscal accountability things we do.
All right. Thank you. Representative Scott, you had your hand up.
Just real quickly, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, the corrective action plans, the 535 and so on, how are those followed up on?
Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative, I believe in the corrective action plans that the school district is given a certain amount of time so the department will say, here's the areas where you have an issue, and they give a certain amount of time, and then the district actually submits a corrective action plan identifying that they have taken care of those issues within a certain time frame.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, if a district waives the open enrollment deadline of January 15, what happens? Does this cause complication for you? Because now that student has to be reported into a new system and removed from another. But I just heard this morning that some districts waive that open enrollment deadline. So I would imagine that's a bit of a complication, or could be.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, I'm not probably the world's best expert on the open enrollment process, but I know that the open enrollment deadlines are different for, I think, districts in a desegregation or city of the first class have a later deadline than other districts, but I believe there is some flexibility granted in the law to waive the deadline. I think the deadline is fairly early, so it's it's before we're actually getting our MARS data in. So I don't think it creates great administrative problems for the department if a district were to push that back. So.
Thank you. That's good to know. Thank you.
Representative Peterson?
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought that you had to submit your student population by October, and then maybe an adjustment was made the following year. Does that make sense?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, we have multiple measures that we collect on students. So for our general education funding program, that's based on the average daily membership. Mm-hmm. So school districts are counting the kids every day. If a kid is enrolled for 160 days out of 170 in the school year, they count as 160 divided by 170 of an ADM. So we need to know how many days they're there all year long. But there are other programs like the compensatory revenue program where the funding is based on the October 1st count. So we get a fall count October 1st for purposes of compensatory revenue. We get data in December for purposes of federal special education child counts. And then we get end-of-year MARS, which shows for each student exactly how many days they were enrolled and in what districts throughout the course of the year. So there are multiple different reports we get. And then in addition to that, in order to make aid payments, we need to get more summary level projections from districts. So school districts were making property taxes last fall for the 2018-2019 school year. So if you've got a referendum levy for $1,000 per pupil, the district had to give us an estimate, you know, almost a year before the school year started of how many kids they would have so they could make a referendum levy. And then in that situation, we wait till the year's over, we get the final data, and then we have to make an adjustment to the levy later to catch up for the difference between what they thought and what actually happened.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this, you probably, I've been trying to find out this answer, and I haven't been able to get it, and maybe it's just not possible. But I'm trying to get my arms around how many students are served with mental services, whether it's through Department of Human Services, mental health school grants, or students are using their private insurance and getting services that way, but they're still doing it in our schools. Is there any way to find out that information?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, not to my knowledge. We have a student accounting expert, Sharon Peck, who's the greatest, who's been around for 30 years, and I could ask her that question, but I don't think we get information, especially about what other agencies are doing. Our MARS information does have a variety of characteristics of students. So we use that data for the kind of race, ethnicity kind of reporting. We have information on student achievement in there. We have a variety of information, but I don't think we have data on whether they've seen mental health practitioners.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's see. Representative Scott, did we cover your questions already?
You did.
Okay. One question I had for you, Dr. Melcher. You know, we made some changes to compensatory revenue for the increases that were coming with the budget that was passed for our schools last year, and I noticed under your audit page that compensatory seems to be one of the top line in terms of numbers of audits. I'm wondering what changes maybe were made or how the department's able to determine if that in the requirement was that the new compensatory funding that's coming is to be used for extended time, how the department's able to monitor that.
Madam Chair and members, when we audit compensatory revenue, we're looking at the eligibility of the student for free and reduced lunch. We're not looking at how the district used the money and whether they spent the right amount at each building and that sort of thing. So we're checking when school districts report their students as eligible for free or reduced lunch, the parents are either filling out a form that identifies their family income level, or they are on a direct certification list from the Department of Human Services or something like that, and we're going through and checking that individual data at the district office to make sure that the students they reported for free and reduced lunch actually were eligible. And so quite often our findings are, well, they reported the individual, but the salary that they actually showed on the form was too high to be counted. And so we take away money if they were not reported correctly. But our auditing does not allow us to go in and say, well, we think the district, you know, there's like a list of 14 things you can use compensatory revenue for, and we don't audit the expenditures in terms of questioning whether they're spending the money on the right things. And I know you have the new requirement for the use of compensatory for extended time programs, and we're getting a lot of questions on exactly what a district can do if they don't have their own area learning center. Can they have their own extended time program? A lot of questions about how to use it, but I don't think our audit system is sensitive enough to be able to catch that. Now, there will be a requirement for districts to do some new accounting, but I think it's too new to see that showing up in, for example, the fund balance statement, because that would be based on the new year and whether they spent the 1.7% the first year and so forth.
Okay. Thank you. And maybe that would be more, Mr. Keith, would that be more in a kind of a program assistance or monitoring question?
Well, it's a formula program, so we don't necessarily have a program component. We do have I'm thinking of Mary Berry, who works in our Office of Career and College Success. She works a lot with alternative learning centers. I know she's provided a lot of technical assistance and addressed a lot of questions around this issue. So probably the primary system we've used is through providing technical assistance when districts have asked for supports.
And, Madam Chair, our office works with Mary, and so we try to make sure the department is speaking with one voice in terms of what are the allowable uses of this revenue, and then we try to build that into our UFARS manual so that in the future people know what to expect.
And I believe Mary's offered some guidance, some program guidance as well.
All right. Thank you. Do we have other questions? No. All right. So thank you both, gentlemen. We really appreciate the information and your presentations today. We have a couple other things to go over. First, our nonpartisan staff has prepared a handout which was just passed out to you, School District Accounting and Reporting. And so, Mr. Strom, do you want to go ahead and just walk us through what this information is?
Madam Chair, members, much of this is similar to what Mr. Melcher just told you about. The joy and the benefit of the UFARS accounting system is that we can track on an accounting basis by program, by object, by fund. And that's great for all of the things that fall into those categories, but it's very bad for some of the other places where you've requested information where those characteristics won't separate out exactly how money's being spent. So if you turn to the second page of that form, I just want to highlight a couple of these areas, the biggest of which perhaps is the compensatory revenue that you were just talking about. And as Mr. Melcher said, the compensatory revenue, they can tell by program, by object, essentially what category of teacher or what other listing there by, whether it's administrative or benefits or whatever it is by that category. But below that, in terms of how that money is actually used, the UFARS system doesn't work very well. So, for example, on the Safe Schools Levy that folks were talking about earlier, we can tell how much is spent on mental health staff hired by the district because they've got their own code. But when we look at contracts, for example, for sheriff services, for school liaison offices, under UFARS, that's all lumped together under contracted services. And so there, the UFARS system doesn't help us determine whether that money is spent for sheriff liaison officers or other kinds of contract activities. And with those 14 uses in compensatory revenue, it's much the same way. The UFARS system will let us see how much is spent on classroom teachers, but it won't tell you how much of that is for reading programs or smaller class size or some of those other things on that particular list. So sometimes when the legislature lists requirements like those, the UFARS system won't give you the answers that you'd like to the question about how is that money really being spent outside of an accounting perspective. So what I listed here on the back are just some of the specialized reporting requirements where the legislature has asked data to be reported, and these will probably be issues that we'll be talking about with some of these programs later this session.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Strom. Ms. Farah or Ms. Adrian, sorry. It's still early in session. Either one of you had a comment on that, or Mr. Strom's got it covered. Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Strom about the information sheet? All right, if not, I know we have another testifier, Ms. Edison with Educators for Excellence. Yes, and I did give you permission to use the whiteboard. I was asked.
I rolled it under my car.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, representatives, thanks for the opportunity to testify on this important issue. My name is Madeline Edison, and I'm the Executive Director of Educators for Excellence Minnesota. And this issue is timely because we are an organization that works with about 2,000 teacher members across the metro area and invites them to be part of a process of creating innovative policy solutions that will elevate the teaching profession and improve outcomes for students. And our members this Saturday will be releasing a new policy paper, a piece of which you have in your packet. It looks like this. It says increase financial transparency. We are releasing a policy paper entitled Our Students Can't Wait, and it is about equitable funding and resource distribution in our schools. Our members sought to explore whether or not the one core question they sought to address was, are the resources that you all at the legislature are directing towards the students who have the greatest needs actually reaching those students who have the most needs? And spoiler alert, for those of you who plan to read the paper, the answer was, we don't know. We couldn't figure it out for some of the reasons that the previous presenters mentioned. And there are a lot of complicated factors that play into this, and I'm going to illustrate one of those today, the average versus actual teacher salary component that Mr. Keith shared about. And I'm going to ask for your support to and show how you can help to support MDE in complying with these new requirements under ESSA. So it looks intimidating, right? Because it is. So here's you all at the state. You allocate money to districts. And one thing that you may know is that Minnesota has one of the most progressive funding formulas in the country, meaning that we are doing a really good job of directing funds to the students that need it most at the state level through compensatory revenues and other sources of funding. So I'm going to walk you through a higher poverty or higher needs population of students in a school serving them, and then a lower poverty school and a school serving them, and how the money does or doesn't flow to those students. So you are allocating additional money over here for those students, whereas over here you're allocating the general revenue population. It goes to the district. And the district from there allocates the funding to schools. And this is a district-specific example. How districts do their budgeting impacts whether or not it actually reaches those students. And here's one example of how. If you have a school of 100 students, both of these schools, a district like Minneapolis Public Schools will take some of the money that you've directed and they'll hold it for district-level purposes. But the remaining revenues, then they will allocate in budgets at a per school basis. And so if you have 100 students in this building and 100 students in this building, the district will then allocate FTEs, full-time employees, to serve those students. So say in this building you are serving 100 kids, you get allocated 10 FTEs. Now, the thing that gets really murky and the problem with equity can play in when it comes to how they then allocate the salaries. So in this district, they are using the average teacher salary across the district. So they take all of the teachers across the district, average their pay, and say in Minneapolis Public Schools in 2014, that was about $70,000. So 10 FTEs, $70,000, this school, the higher poverty school, gets charged $70,000 per teacher, which totals $700,000. And it'll be the exact same for this higher poverty school. That's what the budget allocation goes to, despite the fact that we know what actually plays out in our schools is that the teachers who are serving these high-need students who have greater needs are among the least experienced, sometimes less qualified teachers who also have the lower salaries. So maybe $55,000 or $48,000 or even up to $60,000. Whereas the low poverty school, on average, we see these schools have teachers who are more experienced and thereby making more money. Maybe $70,000 right at the average or even up to $90,000 in some cases. So when you total that out, the result, the actual cost of salaries for that full building in a low-poverty school might be more like $754,000, whereas the actual salary cost of the teachers in this building is about $531,000. But regardless of the fact that this school has less experienced teachers that are making less money, they still get charged this full amount by their district. And so that is a possible way where these students who are generating this revenue might be subsidizing the cost of these salaries that are playing on the district. Now, folks in the district office might say that the way that this is offset is that these students have lower class sizes, additional staff, and that may be true. But the fact of the matter is, when we dig into the data at the report card level, we just don't know. We aren't seeing how the revenues, including local revenues, philanthropic funding, PTA funding, is adding up on the revenue side, and then how it plays out at the expenditure side at a per pupil basis. So I illustrate that to say that you can help address this transparency issue by doing a couple of things. So we have, as an organization, recommended that you ask the Office of the Legislative Auditor to conduct a full review of school funding so that you can answer this question. Are the students with the greatest needs actually getting the resources that they are entitled? And so this digs into some of the issues that were raised earlier about how these funds are actually being spent and how these things are actually then being reported on the back end. And so then, from there, if you are able to get a report where the Office of the Legislative Auditor can dig into some of these questions and find out how schools are budgeting, how they are using the UFAR system, then you can help direct MDE on the reporting side. And on this second page here, we have an example. Our teacher members put together this sample report card, is what they would like to see on the financial transparency side. So we put some recommendations together. But based on the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report, there may be other things that you might want to direct or support MDE to implement as well. And so when MDE gets that opportunity, of course, there will be needs for training and supports to districts to make sure that we are effectively training schools on how they should report the data and monitoring whether or not it's accurate. And after that, hopefully we'll be able to equip families, teachers, and students themselves with this kind of data to be able to advocate for themselves and their schools to make sure that we've got adequate and equitable funding. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Edison. Any questions for Ms. Edison about her beautiful chart? Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. An excellent presentation, as usual. Did you send an email to the Office of the Legislative Auditor to recommend this particular audit?
Ms. Edison.
Madam Chair, Representative, we did.
Thank you very much.
Other questions? All right, seeing none, and we are at 2:45. Yes. Thank you so much, Ms. Edison, for representing Educators for Excellence. I appreciate it. Thank you so much, members. Two really good topics today. Appreciate you hanging with us as we switched subjects there right in the middle. So we are adjourned.